On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
The motto on the side of our car says to protect and to serve. Well, that's what we do. That's what we're supposed to do. But increasingly, we had fewer resources to do it, largely as a result of systems that were put in place in the 50s and 60s. The real model of the LAPD, which I saw firsthand when I got here, was too few who for too long had been asked to do too much with too little. And you get what you pay for. In the case of the LAPD, you weren't paying much.
That was then Chief William Bratton in October 2009 during his last week as LA's police chief. Today, Bratton announced he's ending his nearly five-decade policing career. He's stepping down as commissioner of the New York Police Department. Bratton took over that department, the one here in L.A., in 2002. At the time, the LAPD was plagued by scandals and by racial tension and under federal oversight as well. Over the next 7 years, how did he change the force? In the midst of a national conversation about race and policing these days, we look at his impact on law enforcement right here in the City of Angels. Jim Newton is the editor of Blueprint, a journal put out by UCLA. He's also a former LA Times editor who's written a lot about the LAPD. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
You bet. Why is this such a big deal, and how important a figure is Bratton in modern policing?
I think it's probably safe to say that he's the most important policing executive of the late 20th century. No other person has run both NYPD and LAPD, and of course he did Boston to boot. He saw dramatic declines in crime in both cities during his tenure. So I think he needs to be regarded as at the top or very close to the top of important police officials of our time.
And we are talking about him 7 years after he left Los Angeles, right? So, I mean, that does say something.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was clearly a very significant figure in the life of this police department. And even though it's a very difficult department to take over from coming from outside, as other chiefs have learned, not the case for Bratton, who ran a very impressive run here.
You know, we started the show, Jim, at the top of the hour. We heard Bratton talking about the LAPD being under-resourced, underfunded before his tenure. Was he right? And give us this general snapshot of the department at the time. And let's go back to 2002.
Yeah, well, he is right, and he's still right. I mean, it's still underfunded, but it was worse then. The LAPD historically, at least in the late 20th century, has been built around a car-based model. And the idea there is sort of minimal resources. Initially, the idea before community policing came into play was officers would respond to 911 calls, interact very briefly with the public, lock people up, take them in. So that had its advantages. It was cheaper than traditional policing. It was cheaper. It minimized opportunities for graft and corruption. At the same time, it led to this real powerful sense that the LAPD was a so-called invading army, where officers largely lived outside the city, came in a few days a week, arrested people, and went home.
Bratton increased the LAPD by what, like 800 to 1,000 officers?
Yeah,
about
I think
that
that's
time?
Right. And it remains far below, I think, what he and most other observers think it should be, which is somewhere more like 14 or 15,000 officers, where it's more like 10 now. Vastly underpoliced compared to a place like New York City, which, although bigger geographically, is much more compact and has, at least my last check, somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 police officers.
Yeah, L.A. is much more obviously spread out than New York. Right. Bratton is known here for what he calls community policing, Jim, focused on prevention, which sounds warm and fuzzy, obviously, but it's not really. What did community policing look like here in Los Angeles?
Well, first of all, community policing in Los Angeles predates Bill Bratton. Ed Davis, chief back in the 70s, really is the first one to introduce the notion here in Los Angeles. What I think Bratton brought to that conversation is a strong reliance on data and mapping. This is a system known as CompStat that he pioneered in New York. In fact, I first met Bratton when he was still New York Police Commissioner when I went back to take a look at it because so many people were talking about CompStat. What CompStat does is it arrays crimes literally on a map and shows that there's relationships between crimes. So if you have a community where there are a lot of outstanding gun warrants, you're also likely to have a community that has a lot of murders. And so what his real innovation is to say, if you crack down on some of those lower-level crimes, in this case, my example, gun warrants, you'll yield a powerful result on more serious crimes as well. So using that technique first in New York and then in L.A., and I assume again in New York when he went back, I think he really did help drive down crime to historically low levels.
Are those practices, Jim, still being engaged today? Do we still have this sort of computer, this technology-driven, data-driven police force?
Yes, although I should emphasize, while the data is at the core of it, really the essence of CompStat is the conversation that it creates. And this is, at LAPD, it's a regular gathering, I think it's every week, where commanders and representatives of different divisions of the department will meet and go over the data and ask questions about what it's saying. Why is it that there might be more, you know, nighttime liquor store robberies in such and such a neighborhood? Is there something going on? Is there street repair? Are there lights out, et cetera? So it's the data that generates the conversation. It's the conversation itself that's really instrumental in fighting crime.
I know crime went down in Los Angeles significantly under Bratton. This is between 2002 and 2009, mm-hmm. But it went down pretty much everywhere in many urban areas across the country. So can we really attribute that to Bill Bratton?
Good question. I think, you know, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, most academics in those days were arguing that policing really was irrelevant to crime. The crime was more about economic conditions or demographics or drug habits, et cetera. I think almost nobody believes that now. I think everyone, most credible people who study policing now, would say that police are at least some big chunk of that. And yes, you're right. I mean, there are other things at work in society and in the country at the same time, and they're having their own effects. And that might be what is responsible for some of the national numbers. But the numbers in both New York and L.A. really do stand out. I was just looking at this this morning. I was looking at 2002 homicides, Los Angeles, 658, and then the year Bratton left, 315. Well, that's 300 odd people who were alive. Not to mention their families and friends and others who were unaffected by a homicide that might have occurred in the absence of a thoughtful policing strategy. So I don't think it's fair to give him credit for all of it, but I also don't think it's fair to give him credit for none of it.
But what cost to civil liberties, I guess, is because there's a lot of criticism that, you know, the broken windows theory, that he employed, that it really hurt the city's most vulnerable, especially people on Skid Row.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple things to that. First of all, I think there's a difference between I think people mean different things when they talk about broken windows policing. Broken windows is really an acknowledgement that community decay can breed crime. And so it's really not entirely a policing strategy. It's really a government strategy. And there's nothing about broken windows that mandates that all, you know, it's not the same as zero tolerance. In other words, it doesn't mandate that everyone be arrested. So the way broken windows is employed, I think, is much more important than what it is in theory. And, you know, yes, I think you're right that sometimes cracking down on lower level offenses can exacerbate tensions between police departments and the people they're arresting. At the same time, I think it's also worth remembering that the vast majority of victims of these crimes in these neighborhoods also are minorities. And so when I say that, you know, there's 300 fewer murders in L.A. in 2009 than there were in 2002, most of those murders likely would have been of black and brown people. So there's stress on all sides of the system. And I think Bratton handled it better than most, although I would also say he could be brash, he could be outspoken, he could be arrogant. So he's not a healer, you know. I mean, he really has been focused on crime, and sometimes I think that probably has antagonized people.
You think he's a relic these days? I mean, you know, he did employ the stop and frisk in New York, or was one of the people who did that. Do you think, I mean, those are dated things that are things of the past?
Yeah, I don't know if that makes him a relic, although I guess if he's retiring, sort of by definition, he's about to
Well, he'll probably go into consulting, right, which is
yeah,
the
right,
private
yeah,
sector.
I'm sure you're right. He has before. Yeah. I mean, listen, I think that policing is much more sophisticated than when I first started covering LAPD in the early 90s. And the integration of academic studies and data and mapping into policing is, I think, by and large to the good. But it also depends on responsible managers of departments. It requires people to find the right balance between protecting minority communities and harassing minority suspects. And so I don't know that there's a theoretical perfect point in that. That's really much more of a management job than it is an idea or a theory.
Jim Newton, the editor of Blueprint, a journal put out by UCLA, former LA Times editor too. Jim, thanks for your time.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, There's a crucial presidential election coming up in a few months, and the focus on voting laws is once again front and center. Mostly Republican-led legislatures passed strict voter ID laws in recent years, citing voter fraud concerns. And those states are mostly in parts of the country that used to fall under federal supervision when it came to protecting voting rights. But then in 2013, something changed. A U.S. Supreme Court decision changed all of it. Critics insisting that the laws discriminate against minority voters and give Republican candidates a leg up, but voting rights proponents are fighting back, and they're winning these days. Ari Berman writes for The Nation. He's also author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. I want to start with the latest victory for voting rights advocates in North Dakota. Let's head way north to North Dakota. What happened there?
So in North Dakota, a court ruled that the state's voter ID law discriminated against Native American voters and needed to be blocked for November. And that was the sixth state where courts have ruled against Republican-backed voting restrictions in the last 2 weeks. So this is really a remarkable string for voting rights after a series of defeats, beginning with the gutting of the Supreme Court in the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court in 2013.
What we just talked about. Now, this was the sixth court decision, number six, rolling back voter restrictions in the last 2 weeks alone. What were the other cases?
So the most significant case was in North Carolina, which really passed the most sweeping voting restrictions in the country. A month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina didn't just require strict ID to vote. They cut back a week of early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They eliminated pre-registration for 16- and 17-year-olds. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that that was intentional discrimination against African-American voters.
Well, they said with almost surgical precision. Those were their words, right?
Remarkable language for a court of appeals to use, that that Republicans targeted black voters with surgical precision, and that some things they did, like eliminating voting on the Sunday before the election, when African-American churches hold souls to the polls of voter mobilization drives, the court said was as close to a, quote, smoking gun as you'll ever see in modern times. So that was one really significant victory. There were also victories against voting restrictions in Wisconsin and Kansas and Texas and Michigan, in addition to North Dakota in the past 2 weeks.
How did we get here, Ari? I mean, remind us about that 2013 SCOTUS case, this Shelby County versus Holder, I think was the original case.
So we got here in two different ways. The first way we got here is after the 2010 election, when Republicans intensified control of many, many states, we began to see a wave of new voting restrictions, that half the states in the country passed laws to make it harder to vote, whether requiring new forms of ID to cast a ballot or cutting back on early voting or making it harder to register to vote. And those efforts were really kicked into high gear after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, because those states with the longest histories of discrimination, like Texas and North Carolina and Georgia, they no longer had to submit their voting changes for federal approval, meaning that they could either implement the laws that were previously blocked under the Voting Rights Act, like Texas's voter ID law, or they could implement more sweeping restrictions like we saw in North Carolina. It's only now, 3 months before the election, that courts are ruling against many of these efforts.
I know lawmakers, GOP lawmakers, Ari, say that voter fraud is rampant, that they're tightening these laws to curb that fraud that's out there. Is there any legitimacy to that argument? Can they be backed up? Can they say, you know, look, this is a problem in this country that needs fixing?
Well, both liberal and conservative justices rejected these arguments in states like Texas and North Carolina recently. And in fact, in North Carolina, they said that the laws would make the problem of voter fraud worse, because North Carolina required strict forms of ID to vote in person, where fraud is virtually non-existent, but not for absentee ballots, where fraud is far more common. And the reason why North Carolina did that is because black voters and Democratic voters are more likely to vote in person, and white voters and Republican voters are more likely to vote absentee. And so the court in North Carolina basically said to the Republican legislature, under the guise of fighting voter fraud, you've actually made the problem of voter fraud worse to benefit your own party. And that's why they said that this was really a pretext. Claims of voter fraud were a pretext to try to disenfranchise black voters who are heavily Democratic in terms of how they vote.
Is it a dog whistle, Ari? Is that what this is? Is it a, hey, you don't vote for us, so we're going to make it harder for you to vote?
I think it's an unfortunate intersection of race and partisanship, that because black and Latino voters are such strong supporters of the Democratic Party nationally and particularly in places in the South, that Republicans have decided that instead of reaching out to these constituencies, they're going to instead erect new barriers to their participation in the political process. And in North Carolina and elsewhere, courts have said it doesn't matter if you're doing this for old school racist reasons or you're just doing it for partisan reasons. The fact that voters of color are being intentionally discriminated against is a problem regardless of the motive.
How do you think this is going to play out in November? I mean, there are more cases to be decided. I guess there are so many other cases that are before these appeals court judges, right?
So a bunch of cases are working their way through the courts in really important swing states like Ohio and Virginia. There are lower court decisions that are currently being appealed, and there are appeals court decisions that are currently being appealed to the Supreme Court. Now, one very important factor is the fact that the Supreme Court is deadlocked 4-4, so they're unlikely to hear many of these cases. So the Court of Appeals right now are likely the last word, and that's what makes these decisions in late July, early August so significant.
I don't want to minimize, when I ask the dog whistle question, I don't want to minimize the fact that there is something called voter fraud. But is it that prevalent? Is it all across the country? Because I read statistics, like there were out of a billion votes cast, like in the past 10 years or 15 or 20 years, that there were like 30 or four dozen cases of voter fraud. Is that right?
That is right, that there have been major studies showing that since the 2000 election, out of a billion votes cast, there have only been 31 cases of voter impersonation, which is the type of fraud that you hear about most commonly that a voter ID law would stop. And that's because voter impersonation is a really stupid and inefficient way to try to steal an election. So, I mean, and it's already a felony if you get caught. And so that's why voter fraud is exceedingly rare. And when we hear claims, for example, that Donald Trump says the election is going to be rigged, we should take it with a grain of salt, because in case after case, whether it's Wisconsin or North Carolina or Texas, judges across the ideological spectrum have examined these laws and found that voter fraud is an exceedingly rare problem. And in fact, many more people are disenfranchised by these laws than cases of voter fraud that they're supposed to prevent.
It's one of those things. And again, when Republicans talk about this, they talk about 1960, the 100,000 voters in Chicago that were dead people who voted, right? So there are both sides to this argument, to be sure. Ari Berman, writing for The Nation, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which is out on paperback today. Ari, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right. So have voter ID laws and restrictions gone too far in some states? How much of it is about politics? How much is truly about stopping voter fraud? Reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, juveniles who are placed on sex offender lists and what that means for the rest of their lives. That's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, filling in for Madeline Brand today. California has some of the most restrictive sex offender laws in the country. People here who are convicted of a sex crime against a minor are placed on a sex offender registry for life. And the consequences for those who make the list are dire. Less well known, however, is that juveniles can also end up on that list, on that registry, and they can end up for playing doctor or for sexting or for engaging in consensual sex. Eric Berkowitz is an attorney and author of The Boundaries of Desire, A Century of Bad Laws, Good Sex, and Changing Identities. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You bet, Eric. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend. The title was Punishment That Does Not Fit the Crime. And you cite some pretty powerful examples, including a guy named Matthew Grattaglio. Tell us about this gentleman.
Yeah, Matthew was a very, very moving case. Matthew was a kid in Texas back in 1998, who, with one of his brothers, engaged in a touching game with his younger sister. That got to his teacher, and when he was 11 years old, he was arrested and thrown in jail.
And at 11, at 11.
At 11 for aggravated assault on a minor. And then when he got out of jail a couple years later, he was on that state's, on Texas's sex offender registry. And once that came out, that pretty much was it. He was a marked man. People were throwing, or marked boy, throwing firebombs at his house. His life became absolute hell. And it's, in fact, he's in his late 20s now, and the horror hasn't stopped. Once you're on the registry, you're basically never going to get off, and the restrictions on your life are pretty astonishing. And so Matthew was just one of many cases that I found around the country of young kids, I mean young kids, finding, you know, doing what young kids often do, and finding themselves caught up in a tangle of laws that were meant to protect kids. What I found was that the same laws that we all think are there to protect kids actually ended up targeting them, and through the, you know, ever-increasing restrictions put on sex offenders' lives, pretty much guarantee that these kids will, far from being rehabilitated if they needed it, will live a life of poverty and exclusion. And so I wrote the piece after talking with a number of people and doing a lot of research, and it built on some of the stuff I was doing on my book, to let it be known that, you know, sometimes well-intentioned laws have very, very rough results.
Could things like what happened to Matthew Grottaglio happen here in California? What are the laws here in California for kids under 18 that are convicted of sex crimes against other kids?
Well, California, like the rest of the country, has been subject to periodic panics. And we've had, we've had Jessica's Law and a number of other panics in which people simply vote in laws which they think are making things harder on sex offenders, but actually end up having, you know, different results. California is a little bit better and a little bit worse. Okay, California, you don't get put, if you go to juvenile hall, if you get put in custody when you're a kid for doing any one of a number of things, including lascivious action, which could be anything, or annoying a child, even if you are a child, you're going to get put on the private registry. But make no mistake, there is no such thing really as a private registry.
Yeah, well, what is a private? Yeah, tell me the difference.
Well, technically a private registry, well, public registries, anyone can go on the internet, type in your name, and find out. Private registries is technically supposed to be a more limited distribution, but that distribution also includes schools, it could include employers, it could include landlords, and from all the experts that I've talked to, and I've put a lot of work into this, the message keeps on coming through, there's no such thing as a private registry. It gets out. And let's just stop for a second. We're labeling kids who are at the start of puberty as sex offenders. Merely the label itself, you know, works. So they're going to be on for life. And if once they reach the age of majority, if another offense comes up, then their prior private registration becomes public. Also, there's one more thing that I want to add. The way that these laws are set up, you really put into a minefield. When you're registered, you have to register. The requirements are almost impossible to fulfill. You've got to let them know every time you move, every time you leave the state, come back from the state. So failure to register properly becomes a felony, and that's public. So many, many, many kids who are even on the private registry will rack up a felony inadvertently for failing to register properly. And then once you look, you see failing to register as a sex offender, it becomes pretty well known instantaneously that you are a sex offender.
You're not maintaining, though, Eric, that we should get rid of the sex offender registry altogether. That's something that no. Would not be a good idea.
No. There is a population, unfortunately, of predators, of adults who you know, who prey on kids and who do it all the time. So, I mean, I could argue with you in a, you know, a different context how many of the million people we have, or 800,000 people we have in this country, you know, fit that description. But for those who are predators, absolutely, the communities need to know about it. But we have a system in this country for centuries where kids, minors, need to be given a little bit of room, a little bit of mercy, especially since their personalities haven't formed yet, and what we consider to, what the population thinks of as a sex offense, being the creep who hangs around a playground or a school, you know, that doesn't fit the description of a minor, particularly a young one.
All right. Eric Berkowitz, an attorney and author of The Boundaries of Desire, A Century of Bad Laws, Good Sex, and Changing Identities. Eric, thanks for your time.
Glad to be with you.
We appreciate it. So what do you think? Should juveniles be off limits for the sex offender registry? Let us know what you think. The number is 844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can catch us on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, growing up gay in fundamentalist America.
People would be quickly shamed and brought to a point to where they would be willing to do almost anything. If you're drinking this kind of poison every day, it's going to affect you.
A new memoir about ex-gay therapy. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand today. The Republican platform ratified last month says that parents should be able to choose proper medical treatment and therapy for their children. And that includes so-called conversion therapy to cure their gay sons and daughters of their homosexuality. Garrett Conley is an example of the failure of that scientifically debunked treatment. Conley grew up in rural Arkansas as a Mission Baptist. His mother and father were devout, to say the least. Garrett was an only child. He worked at his dad's car lot, where he was encouraged to minister to the customers. Every soul counted, especially the lost ones, they said. But Garrett himself was feeling increasingly lost because there, in the capital of evangelical America, Garrett knew that he was gay. What happened next is the subject of Conley's new memoir. It's called Boy Erased. And it chronicles his time in so-called ex-gay therapy, an intensive program called Love in Action. The fundamentalist group used the Bible and a 12-step-like structure to convince vulnerable, often young people, to renounce their homosexuality. Madeline Brand spoke to Garrett Conley earlier this summer.
Garrett Conley, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, we'll talk about the therapy in a moment, but first, just set the scene for us. What was it like to grow up in the Mission Baptist community?
My father had always taken us to church 3 times a week. We would go Sunday mornings, Sunday evenings, and then Wednesday evenings. He would often lead Bible studies at the cotton gin where he worked, and then he would also lead Bible studies at the Ford dealership. We were not allowed to watch any films that were inappropriate in any way. We were not allowed to read certain books. Harry Potter was sort of on the line. You know, some people hated it, and they said Harry Potter was a seducer of children's souls. And some people, you know, would kind of read it secretly, which is, I was one of those.
You read it
I
secretly?
I loved that book. Oh, yeah.
Why did you love it so much?
I loved it so much because it was an escape. I mean, I also played a lot of video games. And for me, just sort of going into those worlds was really helpful in escaping some of the bigotry that was around me at the time.
Because as this was happening, you were realizing that you were gay.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's really kind of confusing about it, and I try to deal with this in the book, is that there were two narratives that were occurring at the same time. One was that I believed myself to be a devout Christian who was struggling And then there was another competing narrative that said that I could be a gay man and that there were places in the world where I could be one. But there certainly was no place in Arkansas where I could be an openly gay man.
So you go to college, and you have a certain amount of freedom to experiment. And that just comes to a screeching halt soon after you enroll because you're sexually assaulted.
Yes.
And so you reported this, right? Or you tried to report this?
I tried to report it to our pastor that was at the school. It was a Presbyterian school. And she said that unless I had some proof for it, that I shouldn't do anything about it. It was a moment of failure on her part. And at the time, I felt so much shame about it that I didn't really press it any further. But I just found out from another reading that this person has been incarcerated for raping someone else, a minor.
Wow. So, but he actually ends up calling your mom and outing you.
Yes. And the only way I can kind of understand why he did this was that he decided that it was the one way to keep me quiet because, he knew my worst fear because I told him at one point that I was interested in men, that I was struggling, as I put it at the time, with homosexuality. And so I believe that he must have called them because he thought, okay, if I tell them this secret, then maybe he won't reveal my secret.
So he basically assaulted you twice, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this because I'm a high school teacher and a lot of kids approach me about being gay or being somewhere on the spectrum. And I always tell kids, you know, I didn't get a choice about when I came out. I was outed. And it can be a very violent act because once people find this out, especially when he started to spread this in my community, you begin to feel like a pariah. And I always say to kids, take your time. It's your own story. And don't let anybody else do that to you, you know, if you can prevent it.
What was your family's reaction?
Well, my mom immediately came to the college to pick me up. She said that she was going to take me out of school. Well, she drove me home, and my dad closed the bedroom door, and he said to me, you cannot act on these thoughts. If you do anything with them, you'll never see your mother again, and you'll never be in this house again. And so I, you know, having just been raped, having just sort of gotten the punishment that I thought maybe I deserved from God, I agreed with whatever they were going to do. And they consulted their pastor, and the pastor said, this is the best option for your son. He should go to a place called Love in Action. It's in Memphis, Tennessee. And at the time when I went, there were about 250 such organizations, none as big as Love in Action, but there were about 250 so-called ex-gay therapy facilities. And they had brochures that were stocked in churches around the South, and not just in the South. And so this was sort of the way that the church was dealing with the issue of LGBT members in their community.
So this wasn't that long ago. This was,
no,
what, 12 years ago?
Mm-hmm. And we still have, you know, only 5 states so far have passed bans against ex-gay therapy for minors. And it's only for minors.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Garrett Connolly. He has a new memoir out about the ex-gay movement and about his experience in it. The book is called Boy Erased. So let's talk about your time at Love in Action in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds pretty harrowing. I wonder if you could just take us through a day in the life there.
Yeah, so in the mornings, we would have overall group therapy sessions that were called RAP sessions. It's a borrowing from Alcoholics Anonymous. And we would have these sessions where we presented to the whole group what's called a moral inventory. And a moral inventory is an account of any sexual thought or action that has ever occurred in your life. You're supposed to sort of tell it in this really dry prose that does not allow people to, quote-unquote, stumble when they're listening to it. So you didn't want to get too hot and heavy with your narrative. But the end result was that we would sort of, people would suggest Bible verses to read and memorize in order to get over some of those thoughts. So that was what we would usually do in the mornings. Sometimes people would confess to something they had done just verbally. And there was one guy there, I call him T in the book, who continually confessed to having tried to commit suicide. And then that person would be shamed as well. And if you know anything about the ex-gay movement, there were plenty of people who were either, you know, harmed to the point where they couldn't really go on, or they're still dealing with it today. And so there was a lot of that shame going around in the mornings. And then we would usually do some version of like a craft activity, which is kind of counterintuitive if you're trying to make everyone straight. But we would like sort of just sit around, and, you know, one of the activities was to take all of these art materials and create a mask that revealed on the inside what you truly felt and what you truly were, which was supposed to be sort of shameful and horrible. And then on the outside of the mask, it would be the face that you present to the world, which was usually like the nice choir boy. And then sometimes, you know, there were crazy moments. I don't know, because I wasn't there for a long time. I was only there for about 2 weeks. But one of the activities while I was there was sitting and watching sports. So we watched football. And that was supposed to make us more macho, because it was very gender-affirming. And so, like, a bunch of boys would just sit around and watch men play sports,
well,
which, again,
they could have gone the other way then.
In retrospect, doesn't seem to really work. So, you know, there was just, like, when I tell people this, I feel like it's so absurd that, you know, I can't believe that I ever willingly took part in this. But everything was so absurd at the time. Like, you know, if you grow up 18 years thinking that at any moment you could be possessed by a demon, then it doesn't seem so strange to think that maybe some magical spell can come over you as you're watching sports with a bunch of other boys. Mm.
So how were you able to throw all this off? I mean, your entire life of conditioning.
Well, I began to doubt more, and my mom began to doubt more. You know, like, we snuck away once to have a dinner when we weren't supposed to, because you're not supposed to go to any sinful places, which I guess a restaurant could be. And, you know, we went to the Peabody Hotel and sat in there and sort of talked about just everything, like all the people around us. And I think in that moment, we kind of realized that we were not the people that everyone was expecting us to be. She was a new preacher's wife, but she wasn't fitting the role. If you ever see my mom, which she's been to 2 readings already and she's a hit, she wears like almost exclusively lace dresses. She looks a little bit, I mean, people say she looks a little bit like Dolly Parton, but she doesn't like that comparison. But she has like really...
Does she have the
really,
hair?
Oh, yeah. The hair is amazing. And, you know, she just fits that Southern Belle type. Uh-huh. And she does not look like a preacher's wife. And she would always want people to know that. And I didn't really look like a preacher's son. And so I think in that moment, we just sort of, without saying anything, realized that there was a subtle shift occurring. And so after that took place, one of the days in Love in Action, we were asked to perform an activity called the lie chair. And the lie chair was an activity where you sat across from an empty chair and imagined that your father was sitting there, and you had to yell at it. You know, I would say, I'm not actually mad at my dad. I feel kind of sad. And they would say, no, you're lying. You're not completely showing us your emotions. You're hiding something. Like, you've always been hiding something. And I said, no, I'm being truthful right now. I do not feel angry at my dad. I feel sad. And they just kept going on and on about it. And it was in front of everyone. And I said, well, no, I'm leaving. And when I called my mom, she didn't ask any questions and she just came. And one of the counselors, Danny Cosby in the book, he came outside and he said to my mom, your son needs so much more therapy, so much more, like 3 months, maybe a year. He needs to drop out of college. And my mom said immediately, what are your qualifications? I should have asked this earlier. And he said, well, ma'am, I'm a marriage counselor and I also did Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mom said, you know, in sort of this nasty way that I think was very appropriate, what is an alcoholic doing telling my son how to be straight. I don't understand. And so we actually left right then. And she asked me on the way, are you going to kill yourself? And I said, yeah. And I honestly don't remember if I said it because I believed I would actually kill myself, or if I said it because I knew it would be the thing that would take me away from Love and Action. And I think it was maybe a combination of both, but that did it. Because at that moment, my mom, you know, she kicked into maternal mode and said, I'm not taking you back there ever. And then there was complete silence about the subject for years. You know, this lasted about, I guess, 5 or 6 years. And after that, we began to talk about why she had sent me to Love in Action and what her role had been. And listened to her side of the story, which was that she would go into the hotel room where she was staying. When she would drop me off, she would go back to the hotel room and she would lie on the bed and pull the sheets up over her head and just stay that way until it was time to pick me up, thinking, I'm the best mother in the world because I'm willing to do this, and I'm the worst mother in the world because I may be destroying my son. And she didn't know which one was true.
So were you ever angry at your mom?
There were moments of anger for both my parents, but mostly at my dad. Mm-hmm. My mom was willing to grapple with the subject with me. My dad remained quiet about it and still does to this day. But about 2 weeks ago, before my reading in Brooklyn, he called and he said, I know, you know, I can't support everything you're doing, but I do feel happy for you, and I'm happy that you're getting what you always wanted.
Do you feel like you are damaged from your 2 weeks in Love in Action? Do you feel like it did any permanent damage to you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it doesn't take going into ex-gay therapy to be in ex-gay therapy your whole life, because all of the elements that are present in a state like Arkansas, for example, are just heightened in a place like Love in Action. It's like these counselors internalized the bigotry that they had been fed their whole lives and then created a sort of microcosm in which people would be quickly shamed and brought to a point to where they would be willing to do almost anything. If you're drinking this kind of poison every day, it's going to affect you, whether or not you're in a place that's institutionalized bigotry or just plain old bigotry that you can encounter any day.
Well, thank you so much. It was great
thank
talking
you.
With you.
Yeah, it was wonderful to be here with you.
That's Garrett Comley. His new memoir is called Boy Erased.
Coming up on this show, get your walking shoes out. Runyon Canyon is back in business, but we have some suggestions for other hiking trails that could put a spring in your step. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. Lululemon stockholders rejoice. Runyon Canyon is back open today after a four-month closure. City crews shut it down back in April to replace a water main. Now, Runyon is arguably the most popular hiking spot in the city, but L.A., of course, is chock full of great hiking trails, trails that our resident hiking expert Jolie Myers would pick any day of the week over Runyon, apparently, and she's joining us right now. Hi, Jolie.
Hey.
You're going to throw some shade at Runyon, aren't you?
I know. I feel a little bit bad because it's sort of like its birthday today, and here I am going to drag it down.
You're poo-pooing Runyon.
So let's say some nice things about Runyon.
Oh, it's a compliment sandwich.
You know what?
Yeah.
We're going to compliment sandwich it. So here's the deal. Runyon Canyon, it is a great place for a great workout. There are some pretty stellar views. It is relatively public transit accessible, which is always and ever important. There's some great eavesdropping opportunities. Runyon Canyon is something of a scene. If you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. So you can hear aspiring actors talking about their dates with their agents and the scripts that they're reading and the new yoga poses that they're mastering. So there's some great eavesdropping there as well.
All right, so eavesdropping is fun until it's not, though.
But so apparently here's the deal.
You think that this is something about, like, it is a scene. It's a socializing mecca, right?
I think that Runyon Canyon, when I go, it feels like it's a place to see and be seen. It's a place to basically check out your next date. I can't even imagine what the Tinder scene is there. It's fine, but it seems like a pretty homogenous group of people, and it's just not for me.
Isn't that everywhere in
LA,
though? Aren't you wanting to be seen in other places,
too?
So
basically, Runyon Canyon it confirms all of our worst instincts about Los Angeles, and that's why I choose to go to different hiking trails. I love hiking. I do it 3 or 4 times a week here in the city. I am all about mixing with everybody, finding a place where the people watching is about everybody kind of coming together and seeing people from all different parts of the city, all socioeconomic backgrounds. That's my kind of people watching.
Yeah.
Listen, if you like Runyon and that's your deal and that's your scene, you do you. I'm not trying to dissuade you from that. I am here to offer some other options today, though.
All right. Well, let's talk about those other options and some of the places that you look at when you want to go for a nice hike.
So when I'm looking at day hikes, and these are, you know, no more than 5 miles, these are things that you can do before or after work. You can get to them relatively easily because traffic during the week is obviously insane. Good parking, that kind of thing. Griffith Park. I mean, Come on. And that's right by Runyon Canyon.
That's right
It's one of my most favorite places in the entire city. You can get the same kind of workout that you can get at Runyon Canyon. The people watching is better. There's also, Runyon Canyon has a dog poo problem. I feel like the park is coated in a thin veneer of dog poo.
You really took us there, like, while people are eating, right?
Listen, This is about the realness, Steve. there's good dog watching at Griffith Park, too, but it seems like people do a better job picking up after their mutts. Copious parking, the observatory, the beautiful Art Deco gem.
The L.A. Zoo.
Right there. Yeah. The L.A. Zoo, the old L.A. Zoo.
The
which
old
is a very
L.A. Zoo, right,
hike.
Right.
So couple of Griffith Park hikes that I really love. There's one that right when you dead-end Vermont into the park, before it kind of veers off to the left up to the observatory.
Is that by the Greek Theater?
Yeah, it's just past the Greek Theater. There's a little bird sanctuary there. There is a trail just to the left of the bird sanctuary that goes all the way up to the top of Mount Hollywood, the highest point in the park, and it's absolutely incredible views start to finish. The Hollywood sign, you're above the observatory, you can see downtown, you can see the entire city, and you can complete that hike in less than an hour. It's incredible.
Okay, where else? Now, what if you want to get away from the city? What if you're not so much of an urban dweller, but you want to get somewhere that's cooler, let's say?
You know, if you're on the west side, go up into Pacific Palisades. You can get there from the PCH. And there is a park called Temescal Park.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful hike that goes all the way through the park. It's a loop hike, which are some of my favorites. You go up and down a different way. That's what that means. And if you
is
go...
Is that a technical hiking term?
I suppose so. it's like a 4-mile hike. It is a wonderful workout. This is what we call a booty buster.
And is that another technical term?
It's another technical term from we hikers. So if you start and you go up the canyon trail at the back of the park, you're going to pass what used to be a wonderful waterfall. Now it's sort of a picked over carcass of a waterfall after the drought of 5 years.
Yeah.
You get to the top, amazing ocean views. There's tons of wildlife, great wildflowers in the spring. And then you head down the trail at the front of the park, and it's quick and I wouldn't call it easy. I'd call it moderate, but it's a great workout. It's a wonderful place.
And because we always do things in threes, Jolie,
one
give
more?
Us a third alternative, right? A third option here if you don't want to do Runyon Canyon.
Let's talk about maybe let's serve our Pasadena, Altadena friends.
Oh, yeah.
Up there.
San Gabriel Valley.
Yeah, let's do that. So there's a great hike in the San Gabriel Mountains. It's called Echo Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little bit longer than your typical day hike, but it's an absolutely incredible hike. It's maybe about 5 miles. Great workout. Again, I would call this a moderate hike.
And is it a booty buster? Is it indeed a booty buster?
I'm glad that you've imprinted on booty buster.
Good. Yeah, no, I love it. I'm doubling down on that, actually. I'm doubly booting down on that.
So what's great about Echo Mountain, though, is you get to the top and there is an old resort from the early 1900s. There used to be a train that went up there.
I've heard about this resort.
It's really great. There used to be a spa and some tennis courts. So if you're into kind of the old Los Angeles archaeological dig kind of thing, that's going to be a hike for you.
And to be sure, I mean, this is all about getting outside, getting some exercise. Mm. So hiking is like, this is good for you. And I would imagine those other alternatives that you talked about, fewer people, right, than Runyon Canyon.
Griffith Park is going to have quite a few people, depending on what trail you're on. But for instance, I did that trail in Pacific Palisades yesterday, and I passed maybe 5 people on the trail the entire time.
Booty buster? Was it a booty buster?
Absolutely.
All right. I'm going to say that as many times as I can. All right. Jolie Myers with some alternatives to Runyon on this day that Runyon opens up. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
You don't have to take a hike because you're doing double duty here. You're not only our hikestress, you're also talking about feedback.
I hiked from the control room.
You did.
Into the studio itself.
It was quite a hike.
It was nothing.
And you're glowing because of it.
So I am ready to get the wrath of Runyon lovers. I just want to make that shout out right now. That was definitely an opinion piece we just heard from me.
You should see her finger. She's like, come at me. Come at me.
No. Listen. As I said in the thing, if you love Runyon Canyon, you do you. But defend it, too. And so we want you to tweet us, which is at KCRW Press Play, with your defense of Runyon Canyon. We got some other hike suggestions from a listener named Wade Ridsdale. He says that the Eagle Rock Loop north of Trippet Ranch in Topanga is a great hike. And he also says that if you want to give your dog a workout, go to Kenter Canyon.
Oh, right
he
on.
Says it's best to walk two through Mulholland via Mountain Gate. So suggestions, if you want to share your hate as well. You know, I collect hate, Steve.
No, I do. And you harness it.
I
for
harness
power.
It. It gives me.
Yes, you do.
It gives me life.
So, I love Malibu Creek State Park. It's one of my favorites.
That's great. Yes. Yeah. All of your suggestions. Yeah. We want all of that positivity as well at KCRW Press Play on Twitter.
Jolie Myers. Thank you. We appreciate it. That's going to do it for us today, too. I'll be back tomorrow. Talk to you soon. Take care.